On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, I'm Keri Phillips, and you're listening to an Evatt Foundation public lecture on the global financial crisis, recorded earlier this month at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts. And our speakers today are speculating on just how bad a recession we're in for. Steve Keane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Western Sydney, argues that only a few other people saw it coming and that this crisis will be a long one.
I might start with when I started issuing the warnings. That was in December of 2005. I'd started researching what I call the debt deflation theory of Great Depressions in my PhD, working on the advances done by a guy called Hyman Minsky, who's somebody the economic students at the back row who should definitely start looking up as soon as they get back to the library. Because answering one of the questions Bernie posed, who saw this coming, the only answer is Hyman Minsky in the most recent history, and before him, Irving Fisher, back during the Great Depression. And those two men and the theoretical history they're part of really gives us far better explanation of what we've got ourselves into. Indeed, if they'd been heeded, we wouldn't be having this meeting. So I think one of the reasons why we're having a crisis now is not entirely caused by the economics profession, but I believe the direction economics took after the Second World War and was amplified after this period of stagflation in the 1970s is a major contributor to the scale of the crisis we're in and why I don't believe policymakers have any idea of how to get us out of it. In fact, I think what we're going to have to wait on is basically the current set of policymakers abandoning all hope, and certainly the political leaders abandoning hope in them, before we're going to see any sort of change around out of this crisis. Now, as to how bad it's going to get, you have to know what caused it in the first place to have any idea there. And this is again why you tend to get I don't know type answers from most economists, and that goes right up to including people like Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman. The reason they don't know is their economic theory is the wrong one. If you have a model of how the economy operates and it's got no relevance to the real world, you're not going to understand what's happening in the real world when somebody asks you a question about it. So I have for some years have been arguing that economic theory, as it's been taught in universities and as it's commonly believed, is an utterly fallacious view of how the world operates. And I published a book called Debunking Economics to make that case back in 2001. And the reason that economists can't understand what's happening in the economy is, and I know this is going to sound ludicrous to anybody who hasn't actually studied economics, is that economists convince themselves when they're about 18 years old that neither money nor debt matter. Now, if you start from that mental position, how are you going to understand the real world in which, we all have manifestly clear now, money and debt are crucial? Now, the reason they have that particular mythology inculcated into them is that early in their first year courses, back when I did economics and now in second year, because the course has been dumbed down so much in the last 30 years, they learned what's called the money illusion. And they get shown a model which has our proposition made that you can separate a consumer's tastes from their income, and then consumers are all supposed to know exactly what they desire in any particular combination of relative prices. And you say, well, let's say we double all relative prices and double your income. What combination are you going to choose? And the student does the mental exercise or the mathematical or the graphical one and says, we'll do the same combination. Being naive enough not to have credit cards at that stage, certainly when I was going through university, most of these students accept this and go on to believe that it isn't absolute prices and money that matters, it's relative prices, and they end up building mathematical models of how the economy operates that leave out of their equations, out of their variables, both debt and money. Then along comes the real world after 40 years of that, and I'm sorry, suddenly you realize your models don't make any sense whatsoever. So a model that does make sense is Minsky's. And it comes out of the work of Irving Fisher originally. And the argument that Minsky made is we live in an uncertain world. And the mathematical world that economists swallow when they're at university, which is largely known as neoclassical economics, teaches them that you don't need to know absolute prices, you only need to know relative ones, that all transactions are relative, that absolute magnitudes don't matter, and that credit can be forgotten about. Well, it can't in the real world. And that's the lesson Irving Fisher learnt the very hard way in the 1920s and early 1930s. Minsky put it together quite effectively to say that in the uncertain world with financial obligations, absolute prices are the links between the debt you've accumulated in the past and your capacity to service them now. And if you have a world where you borrow money to finance activity, and that's the world we live in, then those absolute prices are crucial. And so too is the level of debt. As the level of debt rises, you have an increasing need to devote part of your current monetary income to servicing those monetary charges. And if you have debt and you're trying to repay it, then the little mathematical model that students get shoved down their throats in first year before they're mature enough to bite the hand of the lecturer that's feeding it to them don't work, because if you do double all prices and double incomes, you do not get back to the same situation, because it's a non-linear process of repaying your debt. You might get 1.73 times as much consumption. You might get 2.03, 2.07. You can't say. So that argument that says you don't need to worry about absolute prices is false. As soon as you allow the existence of a world in which debt exists and which people have some need to pay that debt off over time. So that mental construct sets academic and then ultimately Reserve Bank economists on entirely the long track. It's why they missed this whole process happening. Now, Minsky argues that the world you've got to look at is one which is modelled from the point of view not of a barter economy, which is the mental model that economists adopt in first year and don't realise they've done it, but a Wall Street model. He said in the Wall Street world, it's a world of credit-driven systems with financial obligations being absolutely paramount, an uncertain future, and people trying to speculate and invest to make money. And in that world, they will borrow money in a particular stage of the trade cycle. And here come two more terms that don't turn up in conventional economic thinking: history and time. Now, I don't need to ask the economic students here, have you studied economic history? Because I know the answer to the question. They haven't. History, economic history is abolished from most university courses around the world. So students don't actually learn history when they're doing economics. And I often have seen people who haven't had the misfortune of an education in economics saying to me, haven't central bankers learned about this last stuff? Don't they apply the lessons of history from the 1930s and the 1890s, the 1870s, for those who actually know their history? The answer is no, they don't. They don't study economic history. Well, that's one thing that better change. They also don't study the history of their own discipline, so they have no idea where the ideas come from. I'm proud to say University of Western Sydney, where I teach, is the only university in the country with a compulsory course in the history of economic thought. And history itself is not part of economic theory, nor is time. Again, most economic models work in what's called comparative statics, or what they laughingly call general equilibrium. And all these ideas leave out of existence the very function of time. So Minsky starts from history and time. And he says, let's imagine a time in history where there was a previous financial crisis. Now, you're all thinking, I presume, 1990. Maybe the younger ones are thinking 2000. So 1990, 1991, we've had a financial crisis in the past. Bernie was part of that experience and remembers it well. And as a result of that crisis, everybody is conservative about the amount of debt they're going to consider taking on. That applies both to lenders and borrowers. Because everybody's conservative, the only projects that are put forward for funding are projects that actually are likely to have a cash flow that's going to exceed their financial commitments. And because the economy has recovered from that crisis, however that might have happened, most of those projects succeed. Because they succeed, everybody thinks, oh, we were too conservative last time round. If we'd actually borrowed more money, been more leveraged, we would have made a larger profit. So as a result of that, people start to relax their risk premiums, they become more adventurous, and as Minsky put it quite classically, stability in a world with an uncertain future and complex financial instruments is destabilizing. So the experience of a period of stable growth leads to rising expectations and sets off the next bubble. When the next bubble begins, you suddenly have a period of self-fulfilling expectations for a while, where that high level of investment and a larger growth in the money supply, which is not under the control of the Reserve Bank, but caused by the willingness of borrowers to take on debt, that expansion of the money supply drives up economic activity and makes it profitable once more to speculate on asset prices. You then get caught in another bubble for a while, where partly positive feedback systems that are good, which boost investment and spending and improve confidence, that elusive word, rise and cause a boom in the real economy to take place, but you also have a boom in the artificial economy, the speculative world, and that ultimately comes to be dominate the real world. I remember Robert de Crespigny, I think his name was, one of the classic speculators from the end of the last bubble, saying that he didn't like to invest in real projects because he could only expect a rate of return of 5 or 10%. He was much happier with 20. A 20% rate of return is a recipe for a catastrophe in the future. It can't be sustained. So you get this bubble going on, and then out of that bubble become people like those speculators, the Bonds, the Scasers, and so on of the 1990s, the fast eddies of the most recent period, who only make money because asset prices are rising. They buy assets in a rising market. They pay amounts of money for those assets which are beyond debt servicing of that debt exceeds the cash flow from the businesses. The only way they can get out of trouble is by re-leveraging later for a larger level of debt or selling the asset on a rising market, which is what they do. Now, of course, ultimately, that momentum has to break down because even though asset prices are rising, debt is rising faster. And that's the thing which has been left out of the Reserve Bank visions around the world, including Australia. That rises faster than the asset prices rise. The servicing costs rise faster. Ultimately, you may have a boom coming at it, if we did back in the 1970s and the 1990s. That changes income relativities as well, and that can shock the system internally, turn it around. So wage demands get to be higher than people anticipated. Raw material prices go through the roof and undercut profitability and so on. You then reach a crisis. The asset bubble bursts and you're back where you started again in a debt-induced recession. Now that's the process we've been going through in the Western economies since the mid-60s. The first major financial crisis was 1966. If you go back and take a look at the Dow Jones then and see the collapse that happened then, it was at that stage the biggest stock market crash since 1929. I recommend going and look at Robert Shiller's homepage, where Robert has done an excellent job of assembling long-term data series on asset prices, particularly share markets and houses in America, and you will see that bubble. He has a price-to-earnings ratio where the earnings are over a 10-year period, and that price-to-earnings ratio points out two major bubbles in the past, the 1929 bubble, the 1966. We are now well above that bubble, and so is the driving factor was the level of debt. Now, to give you an idea of how much debt has grown during this whole process, and again, what Minsky talked about was a tendency for the ratio of debt to income to ratchet up over time. The reason for that is you borrow money during a boom, you have to repay it during a slump. You don't quite have the cash flows you thought you'd have to service the debt, so when you've got it down to a reasonable level, it's not quite back to as low as it was before the last bubble began. So you get a series of ratcheting ups of the level of debt. And the more you overlay speculative lending, where you borrow money not to invest in real projects, but to gamble on asset prices, the more you drive that level up. And that's certainly been the case in the Australian situation and the American. If we go back to 1945, the ratio of debt to GDP in America was roughly 45%. So it owed less than half a year's income, in fact, to pay all its debts off if it ever wanted to do that. It now owes 290% of its GDP. That's not factoring in the obvious nettable outcome of all the monstrous derivatives that have been pumped around the system. The most irresponsible element of this most recent crisis is something we've never seen in history before. For those who want to see how bad that is, go to the Bank of International Settlements page and look for the data there on over-the-counter transactions and derivatives. You'll see that as of July of 2008, there was $683 trillion worth of outstanding derivative contracts out there. Now, when that gets netted out, we're going to see a fairly substantial increase even in that astronomical level of debt. Putting 290% of GDP in context, in terms of debt levels, that is 60% higher than the peak debt reached during the Great Depression in America, and about 120% higher than it reached when the Depression began. The reason the ratio was that high during the Great Depression was because the level of debt caused a period of deflation. And that deflation combined with collapsing output meant that even though Americans actually reduced their nominal debt levels from 1929 to 1932, their indebtedness relative to their income rose from about 175% of GDP to 235% of GDP. Now, we're starting this crisis at 290% of GDP. In that sense, I'm saying debt is the actual cause of the disease, and the cause in the American case is pretty close to 1.5 to 2 times as bad as the Great Depression. So I think it's going to be, we'd be lucky to come out of things as well as the Great Depression. We'll certainly come out worse than 1990. People who believe we're going to stop at less than double-digit rates of unemployment, I think, are deluding themselves, and that's unfortunately what economists normally do. We also have deflation hitting us. In the 1930 and 1931, the rate of fall in prices in America was roughly 10% per annum. The maximum rate of fall of prices in any particular month occurred in 1932 or 33, and it was about 2%. The second largest rate of fall in consumer prices in recorded history was November of last year already. So there's all sorts of signals that this could be a worse crisis than the Great Depression. Now, how much confidence do I have in policymakers to get us out of it? None. Several reasons for that. First of all, the people in charge at the moment did not see this coming. Again, Bernie was talking about how economists were thinking they'd abolish the trade cycle. They actually had a whole debate going in American, particularly American journals, but also English ones, called the Great Moderation. And their description, up to and including the beginning of 2007, of what was happening in the macroeconomy, was a reduction in the volatility of the trade cycle. More consistent growth, less bouts of inflation, more stability. And one of those many foolish economic commentators in the newspapers for the London Times had a piece published in the beginning of 2007 called The Great Moderation, which began with the line, "History will marvel at the stability of our era." I don't think he was being ironic. He actually believed it. Even though I support the stimulus the Rudd government's given, why I don't think it's going to work is because of the nature of this particular turnaround. We had a cycle in 73. We had a cycle in 89. Each time the recovery from that cycle involved not restoration of true stability, but a restarting of the engine of private borrowing. If you go back to 1973 in Australia, I think the debt to GDP ratio then was about 45%. It slumped slightly and then it took off again. We got to 1983 or 84, another bubble, a super bubble in debt occurred at that stage, took our debt ratio to about 90%. It slumped to about 85 by 92, 93, took off again. It's now, in Australia's case, peaked at 165% of GDP. If you factor in corporate bond issues, it's about 177% of GDP. That is seven times the ratio of debt to GDP we had back in the 1960s. Now, we don't have to have a period of forever accelerating debt. A lot of fringe thinkers in economics believe that's the case. Probably the best period of economic performance in Australia's history was the post-war period from 45 to 65, even though it includes the credit crunch Bernie talked about a moment ago. Across that whole period, that whole 20-year period, the ratio of debt to GDP was stable at about 25% of GDP. Now, at that stage, debt was doing what debt should, and that's providing working capital to corporations and investment funds for those that don't have enough retained earnings to do it, and a small amount of money for people to buy houses who wanted to own their own houses rather than renting. That's a legitimate function of the financial system. In Australia's case, in mid-1964, the ratio of debt to GDP started to accelerate, and from that stage on, debt was growing 4.2% faster than GDP on average for the next 45 years. Now, that's unsustainable. I know that, again, in having some conversations with Reserve Bank staff, their attitude was, and this is in print from the current governor in a hearing before the House of Representatives Committee about 3 or 4 years ago, that there's an inverse relationship between debt servicing and interest rates. So when interest rates fall, debt will rise. When interest rates rise, debt will fall. That's not at all what happened, unfortunately. A good look at the data shows simply an exponential takeoff in debt to GDP, independent of what interest rates were doing. If you simply look at the ratio of debt to GDP and do a regression on that using an exponential function, you'll find a correlation between a simple exponential growth of that ratio and the actual data of 0.9912. Now, I know most people who don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm saying 99% of the increase in the debt ratio can be explained by simply saying debt grows 4.2% faster than GDP. Now, that is an impossible situation to maintain indefinitely, because ultimately it's going to say debt's going to be 100 times your GDP. Of course, you can't service that no matter what interest rates are. It has to change direction. Now, it's changing direction now, in Australia's case, at a level of debt to GDP that is almost three times what we had prior to the Great Depression. And there I come to a strong criticism of how reserve banks have behaved, because they've ignored the actual dynamics of a capitalist economy, because they haven't understood them, they followed the wrong theories. I might actually add, without often knowing that there are alternative theories. Because they've done that, they've ignored the actual problem as it's run away from us. And therefore, their decisions have actually encouraged the financial system to get back on the speculative bandwagon when they should have been kicking them off it in the first place. If you look at the data, I think it's fairly convincing that if we hadn't had central banks, then probably in 1987 we would have had a crisis about the same size or smaller than the Great Depression. Would have been attenuated by the scale of government, but that would have turned us around. We've gone another 20 years. Now, we therefore, I think, face a crisis which is bigger than the Great Depression, and which our managers of the economy have less of an idea of how the economy functions than we had back in 1929. It's going to be a long one. Thank you.